Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
All right, good evening and welcome to Breaking the Silence. And we have just had an experience, one of the most beautiful days in the most beautiful city in the country, Houston, Texas. And it's just been a gorgeous day. No matter what's going on out there in the virus world, the climate was just absolutely perfect today. So it was just great to be alive. It was just wonderful to have some energy and we just have a perfect show tonight. This is just going to be so wonderful. I've enjoyed watching the numbers of this morning's show at 10 o'clock that we have on Sunday mornings. The numbers are just continuing to rise from people listening to that. And I know we just have a huge number tonight that's listening in on our fourth week of the Warriors of Hope series. And our co-host tonight, Joe Hendershot, is with us. His lovely wife, Darty, is helping take care of the grandchild that is kind of sick. So we ask for prayers for Joe and Darty's grandchild right now, if you could. But Joe is here this evening, and we just have a wonderful program. You're going to want to call your friends and say, hey, listen in, especially if you're interested in juvenile justice, if you're interested in the way children and youth are handled in school systems, in the court systems, in the way wounded children are handled in general, in the legal system. We have probably the real deal tonight in the judicial world that is probably one of the most nationwide, if not worldwide, experts in this field. Chief Presiding Judge, Juvenile Court of Clayton County, State of Georgia, Judge Stephen Teske is with us tonight. So it's just going to be an honor to have him with us. And before we kick it to Joe to introduce Judge Teske to us, I want to remind you that next week we have George Miller. He'll be here, an artist, and that'll be the fifth of our Warriors of Hope program. And then the following week on May 10th, I can't believe we're coming into May already. And May 10th will be a live 2-hour video webcast. It'll be around the world, and we'll have 2 hours with all the guests on the program where you can see them face to face, answer questions and comments, and we're just going to pass the baton back and forth, and so much information is going to be presented in that program. I'm just looking forward to that. But that'll be May 10th, and I think listen to a commercial coming up, tell a little bit more about that program on May 10th. So sit back, relax, grab you a cup of coffee or a soda or sweet tea, and join in with us tonight. You may want to have a pencil and notepad ready to go. And if you want to call in, we love having callers to the program with a comment or a question. And that number would be 888-627-6008. So looking forward to what we have going on tonight. Joe Hendershot, Dr. Joe, how are you this evening? Good to have you with us, my friend.
Thank you, Dr. Williams. Thank you so much.
All the way from Ohio, the great state of Ohio.
Yes, great to be a Buckeye.
There you go. Well, tell me, Doctor, how did you come across Judge Teske? What kind of relationship have you built with him, and what's he done for you? Why do you think, in your book that's coming out that you and Joe, you and Darty are writing, Warriors of Hope, why would Judge Teske have a chapter in that book? Passing it to you, Joe.
Well, first of all, I'll give a little of the official background that Judge Teske's been appointed to several boards by three Georgia governors, including and having served 6 years on criminal justice reform commissions and as well as welfare reform commissions. He's testified before Congress on four occasions on matters involving juvenile justice practices. And so his background is stellar professionally. But so when you hear, you know, his professional background, you know the man knows what he's talking about. But I met him. We met about 10, 12 years ago at the International Law and Policy Conference. We did back-to-back keynotes in Washington, D.C., and I never met Judge Teske before. And when he spoke, he just spoke to everyone's heart on, of course, my topic is on working with wounded kids, and he just really spoke to my heart on the topic of working with wounded kids from a different perspective, from a judge perspective. Right. And so I was so impressed by him that we became fast friends, presented at other conferences, police conferences, school resource officer conferences. He's keynoted twice at my National Wounded Student Conference. Each time he's going to get mad at me for saying this, but each time he gets a standing ovation. So what he has to say is important, and not just important, but it speaks to the heart of our hurting children. We spent some time together this summer in Washington, D.C., was invited to the school safety listening session out there. But I think the thing that impressed me the most, and then I'll kind of let the program run, was he had a quote one time at a conference, and he has many great things to say, as you'll hear tonight. But the one quote that really struck me was he said when he became juvenile court judge that he made it known that everyone needed to learn to work with kids that make us mad. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, that's so true. We don't want to lock them up, punish them. I mean, there's he'll talk about those differences. I'll let him speak to that. But I just thought, wow, that's true. How many people, you know, we just need to learn to work with kids and make us mad. And that doesn't necessarily mean they need locked up or they need a consequence. So he'll speak about the difference between that. And he's just the most kind-hearted, professional people that I've ever met. So Judge, honored to have you here tonight.
That's great, Joe. And you know, Judge Teske mentioned that you get standing ovations the two times you presented. I get standing ovations every time, but it's because I speak too long and they have to go to the bathroom when I'm done. But that's a whole different thing. That's a whole different thing, Judge. Well, Judge, welcome to the program, Judge Teske, and it is just an honor to have you and Dr. Joe with us this evening. And I just am overwhelmed that you are on the program tonight, and it is a true honor. And your resume and bio is just unbelievably thick and deep. And even as close as this coming Tuesday, you will be speaking with the Department of Justice. So you are highly regarded as one of the experts, if not the most well-known expert in this field. Let me just start off with a bullet at you, to see if we can get you spurred off, because I don't think it's going to take much. Your flame's pretty high to begin with, but I'm going to try to throw a little bit of gas on it to get you started off. What is it that our judicial system, our communities, our schools need to understand more clearly on dealing with the youth of today that we're missing the boat on? What is it that we need to hear and understand more clearly? Judge, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Williams. It's a true pleasure to be here, and I
and an honor, and I appreciate the opportunity. And thank you so much, Joe, for that introduction. And it's been great working with you, and I've learned a great deal from you as well, Joe, and I appreciate your heart and I appreciate your head. But to answer your question, Dr. Williams, the thing that is missing in many systems is respect, kindness, and understanding. You know, that it's like many folks have forgotten what it was like when they were a child, when they were a teenager. And, you know, in my work in nearly 21 years sitting on the bench, and, you know, I came to understand early on that it's bad enough that too many kids are suffering every day, various type of plights, their circumstances, whatever it may be, that has wounded them, and that they carry mm-hmm. with them. But it's a crime when the system aggravates their already traumatic, wounded state of mind by not being smart in the way that we handle kids.
You know, those three things that you mentioned, Judge, respect, kindness, and understanding. Isn't that something that we as adults expect from our children, from our youth? Then why would we not mirror that back to them in the way we treat them, no matter what the situation it's in?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think what happens in systems, you know, and there's a number of factors. You know, we're working professionally, whether it's as a teacher, an administrator, or as a judge, a lawyer, a probation officer, or unfortunately for those kids who find themselves removed from home in secure facilities or residential placements. But, you know, we're all getting a paycheck. We're all doing a job. And, you know, we are experiencing demands upon us. And systemically speaking, okay, we go each day doing what we need to do, following the rules, but we forget the most special, you know, aspect of this is the very person that is the child that we have a responsibility to develop in a positive way. And you can't expect a child to have a positive outcome if the adults surrounding that child are not positive in what they give out to the child. Even kids who make you mad, you know, they're making you mad for a reason. And that's one of the issues that I identified early on in my career as I surveyed school resource officers and teachers, my own juvenile probation officers. And that is that we did not have in our system, and I'm going to speak figuratively now, a pause button where, you know, when a child does do something that, you know, we take a, you know, we do a double take and we go, did that just come out of your mouth? Or whatever it is that the kid did, okay? You know, we're too quick to respond in a disciplinary way, whether you're in a school system, which has led to zero tolerance policies, okay, in many of our schools, or even in the juvenile courts where we respond punitively, but we don't do one thing. And that is ask the question, why? Why, Johnny? What's going on here? All right. You know, because the thing is, you know, when kids hurt, they talk to us, okay? But they don't tell us why they're hurting. Many of them don't make that connection, but they do it in disruptive ways.
Yeah. Is a lot of the times, Judge, when they do this and they're acting out, that they're screaming for attention, that I am hurting, I'm in need, I am, somebody please notice me. I'm dying here. I'm hurting here. Is that the case in a lot of these situations?
It is. In fact, I have, I can give an example. And there's a 15-year-old girl, and the SRO at the school got a call that this girl was throwing chairs at the teacher. So he runs down there, and he gets into the classroom, and she sure enough was just picking up a chair, caught her before she threw. The teacher kind of barricaded herself behind the desk. And she then struggled, dropped the chair, struggled with him. He had to handcuff her, you know, for his safety and other safety and her own safety, took her out. Now, in the old days, before I changed the system to create mm-hmm. that pause button, she would have been hauled out in the handcuffs of the mm-hmm. From the school into the patrol car, take down the juvenile court intake, where we would have probably detained her for a serious felony aggravated assault. But now there's a different culture. The SRO instead takes her to his office and asks the question, why? Why do you not like Miss Jones? Oh, no, I like her. Okay. Now he first calmed her down, took the handcuffs off of her, got her some water, gave her some Kleenex. But one thing led to another. It turned out that there was a boy student sitting next to her who leaned over and whispered in her ear what he wanted to do to her sexually. And she got mad. She hollered at him. The teacher calls her out. She then turns on the teacher, and that's when it went crazy. Well, the officer said, but, you know, Miss Jones didn't hear him say that. Why did you get mad at the teacher if you like her? She goes, I don't know. So he kept working with her. It took about an hour. And what it turned out is that her mother's live-in boyfriend was raping her every week.
Wow.
Now, you think about it. You're getting raped every week, and this boy leans over to you and says what he wants to do to you sexually. Then, now, it's not the teacher's fault. The teacher didn't know, okay? She just heard, you know, what she said, which wasn't very nice. But you can understand why the girl transferred it over to the teacher. In her life, no adult was helping her. But you know why? Because she told her mom and her mom didn't believe her. Okay? But here's the bottom line. People want to, I tell you, my way of doing things looks soft on crime. But I'm going to tell you what, if we'd done it the old way that looked tough on crime, hauling her out in handcuffs, not asking why, not trying to figure it out, then we wouldn't be where we are today with arresting and convicting that guy who's now serving 25 years in a Georgia state penitentiary. Now, you tell me who's tough on crime.
Right. You just happen to be tough on the right person.
That's it.
Wow. That's powerful. And I think our schools are kind of dropping the ball with teaching the youth how to handle pressure situations. We need to be just as concerned about the EQ as we are the IQ in the school system to be able to hit that pause button, teach them how to reach for that moment of calmness before you act out. But a lot of these kids, like Joe mentions every week on here, when you're a wounded student, we need to deal with that because they look and deal with things in a different way, and we need to have more compassion for them. I can't wait to hear on the other side of this. And when we get back after this first break, Judge, and then Dr. Joe, I want to jump into throwing out what these letters SRO means. A lot of people at my generation have never heard that before, and why we even have them in the system. So on the other side of this break, don't touch the dial. We'll be back with another segment with Judge Stephen Teske from the great state of Georgia and Dr. Joe from Ohio. So don't leave us. We'll be right back after this break. This couldn't be coming at a better time. Have you ever felt like you were just trapped and couldn't find your way out of darkness? Have you ever felt like you were drowning and fighting to find your next breath? Well, coming in June 2020 will be the second of a three-part trilogy, my new book, Overcoming the Darkness, The Roadmap to Hope. This new book will provide you a step-by-step approach of how to reach that destination, that important destination called hope. Now, two additional resources are going to be made available when this book is released. One, The Map to Hope. It'll be a handy guide that you can carry around with you, put in your briefcase or put in your purse. And this guide is going to help you find your way when you're stuck in life looking and searching for hope. And then the other resource, the Overcoming the Darkness Companion Journal. I have always believed that journaling is the first step to finding real healing and hope in your life. And this journal will guide you down that path. I'm excited about these resources and this new book that's going to be released in June 2020, the Summer of Hope. Now back to the next segment of Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams right here on BBS Radio. Wow. I tell you what. Welcome back. We sure paid the orchestra extra money tonight. They were really going after it, I tell you. Okay. Well, that's okay. Looking forward to that book coming out. I've been working hard on it, and hopefully in the next couple months, if we wouldn't have had the virus, it may be out already, but it gave me a chance to revamp it a little bit and update it a little bit. So that'll be coming out in June. Now, you know, Judge Teske and Dr. Joe, I went to a grade school called Raccoon Grade School. And we were a little country school. We had maybe 18 to 20 in each class, and I think there was about 25 in my graduating class, K through 8. We never heard of what an SRO was. Matter of fact, our SRO was the PE teacher because he was the meanest and baddest dude in the school. And, you know, back in those days, they had boat oars with holes drilled in them that they used for paddles. Back in those days, that's what kept us on the straight and narrow. But in today's world, explain to me, Judge, what do you mean by an SRO for us fuddy-duddies that don't understand what that is? And why do we need them?
Sure. Well, SROs are school resource officers. I mean, practically speaking, they're police officers. I mean, they're certified as any other police officer. These SRO units, so to speak, okay, started to develop in the early 1990s. Keep in mind, as far as the backdrop is concerned, that, you know, during the 1980s, I mean, I don't want to be too detailed. Technically,
right,
crime rates began to go up in the 60s, went down a little bit in the 70s, but then started going up in the 80s and then peaked in 1995 and then 96, they started going down, and in fact, they have been going down ever since. In some places, the juvenile crime rate is at an all-time, is at a rate that it was in the late 1950s. But what happened in the early 90s is that all part of this get tough, we started to pass laws getting tough on folks, both adults and juveniles. With juveniles, you know, many states started doing what's called automatic transfers. And if on a certain, on a violent felony, instead of going to juvenile court, they went straight to adult court. Like, for example, here in Georgia, if a kid, you know, commits an armed robbery with a firearm, they go straight to adult court and their mandatory minimum is 10 years in prison, at least 10 years in an adult prison. Well, along with that, that kind of trickled down, you know, because it was out there in rhetoric all over the place, and politicians were, you know, using that, you know, and this has been, you know, this is documented, using this in terms of politicizing crime to get elected. And so schools picked it up. And so to get tougher on discipline in schools, you know, they started contracting the local police departments, and they would then bring an officer in. The problem was that these officers were not trained in adolescent development, juvenile law. They essentially just took I got to say this: we can't blame the police. We got to blame ourselves for not thinking about this, because they were doing their job. They were trained, to be police officers. So when we decided to put them in the hallways of school campuses, they did exactly what they were trained to do. They started arresting kids for about everything. Okay. Mm. And I could tell you, in my county, when we put police officers in there in 94, 95, our school arrests went up over 1,000%, about 1,200%. By 2002, one-third of all my delinquency filings came from the school system. But here's the thing, Doctor. The thing, that 92% of those filings were low-level misdemeanor offenses, things that are typical of adolescent behavior. Okay, and things that I did, probably you did too as a kid.
Sure.
It's just that you and I were not arrested because we didn't have police on campus.
Right.
And so that's the, I'm not saying that, here's the thing, there's a controversy about having police on campus or not. And the thing is that I was asked one time during a lecture at NYU, a lawyer had asked me, I realize, Judge, that you've been able to bring down school arrests dramatically, but wouldn't the easiest thing to do to fix this would be just to remove the SROs? That's yes and no. It all depends, because here's the thing. My school resource officer culture has changed so much that they have named their approach to do an SRO work as the positive student engagement model for school policing. And in fact, a survey was done on our students by an outside research group, and the students were saying that the first person they would go to if they had a problem or an issue was the SRO. Okay.
Is that because they're building relationships with them and they see them every day and they trust them? So if they step down from their hierarchy of police officer into a caring officer that realizes maybe that this person over here, this Joey, this Cindy, they have baggage and they're aware of the baggage because every child has it, they need to be handled differently than just throwing handcuffs on them.
That's correct. Let me give you an example. Yeah. A really, truly empirical economic, example. Mm-hmm. In 2008, when the market crashed, our county we all had to cut our budgets. And the decision was made to cut out all the SROs in the middle schools, Well, if you were to look at our data, the graph, you will find in 2008 when that happened that there was a spike in the number of arrests coming from the middle schools. The reason why is because when you took the SROs out, the administrators started calling 911, and you ended up getting a street patrolman who wasn't trained as an SRO and did exactly what the SROs did in the beginning when they were not trained. They treated the kids as if they were on the streets, and arrested them. So then when we all begged, and they put the SROs back in the following year, and the numbers went down, So it all depends. I mean, those systems out there that don't have this type of SRO, culture, I'm concerned about those. We've seen them go virtual where we've had police officers in school campuses handcuff kids as young as 8 years of age.
Oh, man.
Okay. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's abusive.
Yeah. Wow. Now, Judge, when we were talking earlier, you made a statement, and I was writing down as fast as I could because the wisdom that you explode out is just unbelievable. But you mentioned, I want to jump on this before, because we got 10 minutes before the next break, but you said something profound that's went something like this, then I'll let you restate it if you wish. But just because a youth commits a violent act doesn't mean they are violent youth. Tell me what that right. means to you, and when you say it, and you use it in two different terms, in two different ways when we spoke, but that's powerful. Explain that to me.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So it begins, first of all, with a foundational statement that I deliver the folks, and something I really harp on, because I'm an adjunct law professor at John Marshall Law School here in Atlanta. And it's this, just because a kid commits a delinquent act doesn't necessarily make the kid a delinquent child. Okay. And the reason for that is why we have a juvenile court system versus an adult court system. Okay. Because the teenage brain the frontal lobe is not fully developed till age 25 for guys. Okay. And for girls, 21, or 23, but that part of the brain is what translates emotion into logic. So it's still under construction, you know. And so if it's still under construction, we need to be very careful, you know, how we manage kids. Because if they're under construction, we don't want them in bad places. We don't want them in negative places if their brain is still under construction. So right. we have a juvenile court that says, hey, wait a minute. Kids are neurologically wired to do stupid things. Now, that doesn't mean they're stupid, so don't get me wrong. Don't take me there, okay? In fact, right. the teen brain is the most brilliant in our entire lifetime development, okay? I mean, Mark Zuckerberg created Facebook by age 20, okay? Mm-hmm. And so, and we can talk about others in teenagers who are brilliant, but there's a reason why Mark Zuckerberg couldn't get a drink of alcohol until the age of 21. All right. And my point is that, you know, because we have to understand that kids are going to do things that may be delinquent, but that doesn't mean that they're in need of that type of treatment or supervision. They're not really delinquent. Now, let's elevate it now. The same principle holds true when a kid does a very serious thing like a violent act. Okay. All right. That doesn't mean that the kid is a violent kid. It may mean the kid really had a lapse of judgment and did something very poor for any number of reasons, whether it's very serious peer pressure, being coerced by friends, okay? But I can tell you during this COVID-19, you know, I had only 15 kids locked up in a 60-bed facility. I mean, I used to have 62 when I first became a judge, and then I said, no, we're not locking up all these kids. They don't need to be locked up. So we have an average daily detention population of about 15. And on that day of the declared emergency back on March 16th, we coincidentally had 15. I immediately released 12 because they were not there in a violent act. Well, you know, here's the thing. We end up having to admit 5 more. Now, as of today, we only have 2 in there. And now the kids that were left in there were violent acts, but I met with them every Wednesday by Zoom conference with their parent, who I emailed an invite to, their lawyer, and the prosecutor. And each week as I got to know the kids and have conversation with the kids, you know, it was revealing. I was able to ascertain, you know, hey, you know, is he really violent? No. Does this kid really have an inclination, a propensity, a character of violence? No. All right. So was it necessary for me to keep him in this secure facility during this COVID-19 epidemic and basically just put him in a petri dish, okay, with the risk? And I said no. Now, so we only have 2 kids in there right now, all right, that I can't let out. But the kids I have let out, none have disrupted. None have reoffended. You know, and I'm going to tell you what it's doing. You know, I'm a detention reformer. I have reduced our average daily detention population from 62 down to 15. Yet our crime rates have gone down dramatically. They haven't gone up. In fact, our felony filings are down 64%. Our total delinquency filings are down 82%. And that leaves people scratching their heads because I'm not locking kids up. I'm not tough on kids. But gee whiz, look, our crime rates are way, way, way down. They went the opposite way, okay? So we need to be smarter about how we approach crime. We have to be even smarter how we approach kids, because many of these kids who do get in trouble, though, are coming from some pretty serious issues that they're dealing with, you know, that they're not going to tell us about. They're not going to share with us. But when children are hurting, Dr. Williams, their behavior becomes their language, and we need to listen to their behavior instead of punishing their behavior.
Yes, you have hit the nail on the head. Now, Joe, what do you think about that one? That statement that he just said, is that not powerful?
Oh, yeah. Language, you know, all behavior has meaning. And we talk about that all the time.
Unbelievable.
I think the thing that, you know, we talked about empathy is the kids, and I think I've said this before, kids today, they make the comment, do you feel me? You know, when you ask them what's going on, and they'll tell you their story, and they'll say, do you feel me? Do you feel what I'm saying? And the definition of empathy is to feel what someone else feels. So our kids today are actually saying to us, hey, can you be empathetic with my story? You know, I want to say this as far as the schools and school resource officers that I've seen in the educational field over the past several years, is I've seen more and more school resource officer conferences on social emotional learning. I spoke at a bunch of them. The educational systems working with the school resource officers. I've done training. I know Judge Teske specifically, when he's been at our conference, there's school resource officers there, school officials, and it's all in the social emotional aspect of how the courts work with the schools. And because, you know, expulsions aren't the answer. Though I've expelled my kids, you know, there's the non-negotiables. But we know kids are going to come back to school, and they're going to come back to school with hope or little hope. And some of the things Judge Teske talks about, you know, for me, you know, like he says, it seems soft on crime, but if you listen to it really deeply, his numbers reflect a change in these kids and a change in everything from academic achievements, better school attendance, higher graduation rates, lower crime. And I think it's a matter of the schools and SROs working with the juvenile courts together. So I'm really impressed with the work. And Judge, maybe you can tell us your program that you do is through, I think, 41 states right now you've been through.
Some of these states have multiple jurisdictions that have replicated my school justice partnership. In fact, for your listeners, where they are right now, they can Google school justice partnership and then put Judge Teske in there. You'll see some references. Some folks have called it the Teske model. But the bottom line is I have a technical assistance team, and it's funded by the Annie E. Casey Foundation for purposes of travel expenses. And some of these places have brought us there on their own dime. In fact, I'm working with Houston right now. I was in Houston in the first week in February and working with some very wonderful folks in your in a number of your independent school districts. We've already hammered out some terms to an agreement, and I was supposed to return in March to help them finalize it. But of course, you know, with this pandemic, I haven't been able to. So anyway.
Yeah, we're going to take our last break real quick, and then when we come back, I want to hear about the numbers, Joe. Judge, about the graduation rates. And go into that, and then we'll go into a little bit deeper. Want to drill a little bit deeper on some stuff. Stay with us. This has been just a great interview. I know you're enjoying it. If you want to call us, we're at 888-627-6008, and we'll be right back after this commercial break for the last segment of Breaking the Silence. Mark your calendar for Sunday night, May 10th,
8 to 10 p.m. Central Time for a live video world webcast event right here on BBS Radio. Warriors of Hope. Warriors of Hope. This video webcast will feature co-host Joe and Darty Hendershot and guest Christian Moore, Lieutenant Colonel Consuelo Kickbush, Roy Jarez Jr., Judge Stephen Teske, and George Miller. Don't miss this live video, two-hour, life-changing event, Warriors of Hope, May 10th, 8 to 10 p.m. Central Time, right here on BBS Radio. Absolutely. That is going to be an absolute awesome time. And I can't wait, Dr. Joe, for all of us to be. I don't know how we're going to get it all in. We may have to just keep expanding it until we're all done. But it's just going to be a great 2 hours of video where we can actually see each other and people can see us. And we'll talk about what we're passionate about and throw out some. I highly recommend this to everybody. It's just going to be an awesome time. So looking forward to that. Judge Teske, you gave us some numbers about how your detention centers and juvenile centers have dropped and how the crime rate has dropped and all of that. But what about going back to school, staying in school, attendance, and then graduation rates? How have those improved or not improved with your program? Explain that to us.
Sure. First of all, it begins with this concept, you know, that I put in a question form, and that is, you know, who would ever think that keeping kids in school would increase graduation rates? I don't think that's a very difficult concept to embrace. And so that's where we had to start, is figuring out what are the offenses that are being, that kids are being arrested on, and ask ourselves, do they really need to be arrested and handled by the juvenile court? And quite frankly, the vast majority of them, the answer was no. And so we created a system where, in lieu of arresting kids and sending them to the juvenile court, we created a system of applying restorative practices that also involve where there are victims as well, and trying to repair those injuries. Because, you know, traumatize people, okay? And many of these kids who are acting out, like, for example, Jane, you know, the girl who's throwing the chairs and was being raped every week, you know, she's being traumatized. And so when that boy said what he said to her, that was a trigger. And so she turned around and traumatized other people. Using the restorative practices are to repair. Now, some of the kids are suffering from toxic trauma, and restorative practices are not enough. And so they need clinical help. So we created this nonprofit that is a warehouse where these kids who are chronically disruptive, instead of expelling them from school, we then get them clinical help, okay? They undergo an assessment and so forth. And so consequently, Dr. Williams, what's happened is that our, when we stopped arresting kids and we started keeping them in school, but not only just keeping them in school, but addressing the underlying causes of their issues. Let me stop for a moment. This is critical, I think, for your listeners, okay?
Okay.
My father was in epidemiology. He retired from CDC, which is here in Atlanta. He taught me back in about 2002, before I started convening everybody, and I was sharing with him what I was wanting to do. And he said, son, you know, the problem with you folks in criminal justice is that you treat the symptoms and not the causes.
Oh.
So when these kids get disruptive, you punish them, but you're not asking why. And he said, you know, what you need to do is a lot like what I did in epidemiology. He said, there are two basic epidemiological facts. And he said, now, son, let me caution you. I'm not saying that disruptive behaviors or delinquent behaviors are diseases. They're not, but they do behave like them. He said, diseases do not occur by chance. There are always determinants for the disease to occur. And number two, he said, son, diseases are not distributed at home. Distribution is related to risk factors that need to be studied for the population in order to identify solutions. And he said, now here's the key to it. He said, I want you to take the word diseases and replace it with delinquent behaviors. You see, son, delinquent behaviors don't occur by chance. There are always determinants for the conduct to occur. And delinquent behaviors are not distributed at random. So if that's the case, if they don't occur by chance and are not distributed at random, that means they could be studied. And if they could be studied, you can identify the causes. If you can identify the causes, you're more than halfway home to finding the treatment modalities, which is what we've done, including the school justice partnership that led us to restorative practices, that led us to clinical responses, okay? Because we started identifying the kids who are chronically responsive, chronically disruptive, 87% of them, when undergoing an ACEs survey, an adverse childhood experiences survey, 87% came back chronically traumatized, okay? Mm. Now, here we are, we're keeping them in school. So our graduation rates went up between 2003, when we started the School Justice Partnership, to 2012, and that's significant because we were, you know, whole country was under a different formula. Graduation rate, which is overall, was 24, went up 24%. Then in 2012, about everyone's graduation rates fell because we went to what's called an adjusted four-year cohort, where you can only count the kids who graduated 4 years from the day they started in ninth grade. But our graduation rates still continue to go up. They've gone up since by 21%. So if the on-time graduation rates, the adjusted four-year cohort, went up 21%, imagine what our overall rates would be looking like right now. Okay, you know. Now, one other thing, you asked me the question. Okay, mm-hmm. So, you know, look at it this way: how go graduation rates, so go juvenile crime rates. The more kids that graduate, the fewer kids you will have in your community committing crimes, okay?
Wow.
All right? So what's happened is that we have seen, and if you look at the graph, which got us going, and regression analysis has been done to determine to what extent, to what degree, is the School Justice Partnership not arresting, okay, increase in graduation rates, and then to what extent are graduation rates as an independent variable influencing juvenile crime. And sure enough, you know, our felony rates filings are down 64%, and our total delinquency filings are down 82%, okay? You know, basically what, and you know what, one other thing, Clayton County, which for those who don't know, okay, when you fly into the world's busiest airport, you're in my county. That's Clayton County. That's mm-hmm. where we are. We're the poorest county in all metro Atlanta. That's right, folks. Our graduation rates are going up in a poor community. Our crime rates are going down in a poor community. In fact, just 2 months ago, one of our local news outlets, you know, had announced, you know, that Clayton County had posted, okay, you know, one of the lowest crime rates in the metro Atlanta area, even though we're the poorest community. That's why people, Dr. Williams, are very interested in this particular model, you know, because they're wanting to know how they can help their poorer communities, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. This is, and I want to, when you come back to Houston, I want to be so involved in this, whatever you will allow me to be. This is just something that we all need. The way you put this, the need that our communities have for this, the statements that you have made this evening are profound, and every superintendent and principal and school board member in this country needs to hear this program tonight and needs to read your materials and your ebooks and the things that you have out there, because this is just unbelievable. Before we start going to the close of the show, there's one more story, Dr. Joe, that you mentioned that he shared, Judge Teske shared with you, I think from a stage in one of your conferences, and I would like, Judge, for you to share that story about the young lady and how you came down and dealt with her, similar to the 15-year-old girl story, but this is so powerful. Can you share that before we close out tonight?
My gracious, I have so many. I am known for coming down from the bench and engaging kids, taking my robe off, and having conversations with them and the family, and you know, giving them hugs and handshakes. Of course, you know, not able to do it right now. But hey, Joe, remind me which child is that? Because I have so many stories.
Well, I think it was the one that you had mentioned about the young lady that we mentioned earlier. But I thought it was in the boardroom.
Well,
I didn't know,
I can tell you this where I came down, Joe.
Yeah.
So I just finished about 3 years ago. I started a campaign here in Georgia to remove shackles from kids in the courtroom, you know, restraints, handcuffs, leg irons and that. I entered an order declaring it for my county unconstitutional in violation of the kids' due process rights, and that restraints can only be put on them if there's clear and convincing evidence that they present an escape risk, meaning that they tried to escape the facility, okay? Well, let me tell you how that began. It began with me coming down from the bench. There was so the young man is walking out. He's an African-American gentleman. He's walking out, teenager. And there's like three generations, mom, grandma, and great-grandma. Great-grandma starts to holler out. I mean, just crying, okay? All right? And then she calms herself down. And, you know, and so afterwards, I end up releasing the kid, okay? He was there on a burglary charge. And I came down because I wanted to have a conversation with him, but I went straight to the great-grandmother. And she put her arms out to me, and she said, "Thank you, Lord Jesus, thank you, okay?" And she hugged me, and I said, "Ma'am," I said, "I'm just curious, why, what upset you? You know, you cried out when your great-grandson came out." And she said, "Seeing him in them chains made me think of slave days."
Mm.
Now, you want to talk about trauma? I ask your listeners to do the research on generational trauma, okay? And I truly believe, because I did the research. In fact, there was a big presentation made at the National Council of Juvenile Family Court Judges just right after that incident, okay? And you research it. And I believe that that great-grandmother, even though she never directly experienced slavery, she was feeling the pain of her ancestors in her DNA. Okay.
Wow.
And I tell you what they were looking at. I'm a white judge. They were looking at this white man up on the bench like a slave block.
Mm-hmm.
And her young black grandson being walked in there in chains as if going to be sold.
Mm.
You see, we got to learn to put on a different lens. We got to stop fooling ourselves. Okay. You know, the thing is, I'm white. It's not happening to me. So how am I going to be sensitive to it? But I can mm-hmm. become sensitive if I listen, if I care, instead of just judge and say, "Oh, no. We're not racist, or we don't have implicit bias, or we don't, you know, just let that go and just listen."
Yeah.
Be respectful.
Wow, that is so deep. There's so much meat on that bone. Those bones,
but you know,
Judge.
I'm sorry, Dr. Williams. I failed to mention the really big part. I was just recently successful in my campaign. Okay, the Supreme Court of Georgia just approved a uniform rule to ban the use of shackles in Georgia.
Oh, that's awesome! So they don't walk in chained up like that now.
No.
Juveniles.
Nope.
Yeah, that's pretty traumatic for any family member to see that. not alone just for the child. Wow. So you're going in front of the Department of Justice Tuesday, Judge. What's that all about? What kind of presentation are you making there?
Yeah, so the president, by executive order, created a commission on law enforcement and administration of justice. And so, one of the things that, that's happened around the country, and the president has also gotten behind that, is criminal justice reform and passing the Fair Sentencing Act and so forth. And so this is a continuation of that. What best practices out there for law enforcement and basically the courts, the administration of justice? And so I've been invited to participate as an expert, and particularly they're interested in the school justice partnership.
That's great.
And so, in fact, a couple of the commissioners that the president has appointed, I know them. And one of those happens to be the former chief of police for Clayton County, who's now a chief of police in North Carolina.
That's awesome. Well, I'll tell you what, if our listeners want to reach out to you, if they want to tap into any of your resources that you have available, how would they get in touch with you and or those ebooks and books that you have? How would they do that, Judge?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me y'all just take a pen and paper, write down my email address. My email address is Stephen with a V as in Victor dot Teske, T-E-S-K-E at Clayton, C-L-A-Y-T-O-N County, GA, so it's Clayton County GA dot gov, G-O-V. And you just, so I do have a number of publications, okay, on this topic in detention, in family court review, regarding the school justice partnership and collaboration. In the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychiatric Nursing, a study of zero tolerance policies in schools, a multi-integrated systems approach to improve outcomes for adolescents. And then in the journal, the Juvenile and Family Court Journal, the dichotomy of judicial leadership, working with communities to improve outcomes for status youth. And I do have an ebook that you could download from Amazon or whatever called Reform Juvenile Justice Now. And it's a collection of essays of mine on various topics. And that I'm getting ready to actually, put out another edition of that with additional essays that have more developed and broadened the subjects.
Wow. And for you, this tells me the kind of man that you are, for you to give out your email that may just get loaded. This goes straight to you. So I appreciate that. And Judge Teske and Dr. Joe, I just appreciate you both being here this evening. And this is so good. This information is so needed. And Judge, when you get to Houston, please let me know. I want to meet with you and at least get a chance to meet you face to face and shake your hand, and hopefully we won't have the virus then and I can shake your hand. But when you get back here in Houston, I'd love to be able to, if there's anything I can do to help, I would welcome that in a heartbeat. Dr. Joe, you have anything before we close out?
Dr. No,
Joe?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
Gotcha. I appreciate the work that Judge Teske does with the schools and school resource officers. As I mentioned before, he's pulling everybody together. I'm not an expert in what he talks about, so I listen to the experts, and I just appreciate the work and the warrior of hope that he is for children,
yes.
And I appreciate his help. So thanks for being an expert in an area I am not, and thanks for all you do for kids and families across the United States.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, there's no doubt in my mind that Judge Teske, you are a warrior of hope in the greatest degree. So thank you for being a champion for that. We appreciate you being here tonight and taking time out of your busy schedule that I know you have. So thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay. Before we close out tonight, we always like to just let you know that next week we will have George E. Miller with us, an artist that is just going to show you how to possibly get all of that anxiety and that stress and what art can do for a person that has gone through abuse and hurt and pain and trauma. And that's going to be next week at 8 o'clock Central Time here on Breaking the Silence. So as we always close out with this one statement, and I say it different probably every week, but the same context is there. No matter what you're in, no matter what's happened to you, no matter what you're going to deal with tomorrow or this very moment in time, I want you to know that there's always hope. There was always hope. And there's people out there that will help you, that care, that will reach out. Don't hold it in. Let somebody know and continue to reach out for that hope in your own life. Thank you for joining us tonight. Have an awesome week and join us right here next week, Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time for another edition of Breaking the Silence. Thank you all and God bless.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1. For the next episode of Breaking the Silence.